The Lovely Bones, Disc 3.
On Christmas Day, my family would have been more comfortable in heaven. Christmas was largely ignored in my heaven. Some people dressed all in white and pretended they were snowflakes, but other than that, nothing. That Christmas, Samuel Heckler came to our house on an unexpected visit. He wasn't dressed like a snowflake. He wore his older brother's leather jacket and a pair of ill-fitting army fatigues. My brother was in the front room with his toys. My mother blessed the fact that she had gone early to buy his gifts. Lindsay got gloves and cherry-flavored lip gloss. My father got 5 white handkerchiefs that she'd ordered months ago in the mail. Save Buckley, no one wanted anything anyway. In the days before Christmas, the lights on the tree weren't plugged in. Only the candle that my father kept in the window of his den burned. He lit it after dark, but my mother, sister, and brother had stopped leaving the house after 4 o'clock. Only I saw it.
"There's a man outside," my brother shouted.
He'd been playing skyscraper, and it had yet to collapse.
"He's got a suitcase."
My mother left her eggnog in the kitchen and came to the front of the house. Lindsay was suffering the mandatory presence in the family room that all holidays required. She and my father played Monopoly, ignoring the more brutal squares for each other's sake. There was no luxury tax, and a bad chance wasn't recognized. In the front hall, my mother pressed her hands down along her skirt. She placed Buckley in front of her and put her arms on his shoulders. "Wait for the man to knock," she said.
"Maybe it's Reverend Strick,"
my father said to Lindsay, collecting his $15 for winning second prize in a beauty contest.
"For Susie's sake, I hope not," Lindsay ventured.
My father held on to it, on to my sister, saying my name. She rolled doubles and moved to Marvin Gardens.
"That's $24, my father said, "but I'll take 10.
"Lindsay," my mother called, "it's a visitor for you." My father watched my sister get up and leave the room. We both did. I sat with my father then. I was the ghost on the board. He stared at the old shoe lying on its side in the box. If only I could have lifted it up, made it hop from boardwalk to Baltic, where I always claimed the better people lived.
"That's because you're a purple freak," Lindsay would say.
My father would say, "I'm proud I didn't raise a snob."
"Railroads, Susie," he said. "You always liked owning those railroads."
To accentuate his widow's peak and tame his cowlick, Samuel Heckler insisted on combing his hair straight back. This made him look, at 13 and dressed in black leather, like an adolescent vampire.
"Merry Christmas, Lindsay," he said to my sister, and held out a small box wrapped in blue paper.
I could see it happen. Lindsay's body began to knot. She was working hard, keeping everyone out. Everyone. But she found Samuel Heckler cute. Her heart, like an ingredient in a recipe, was reduced. And regardless of my death, she was 13. He was cute. And he had visited her on Christmas Day.
"I heard you made Gifted," he said to her, because no one was talking.
"Me too." My mother remembered then, and she switched on her autopilot hostess.
"Would you like to come sit?" she managed. "I have some eggnog in the kitchen."
"That would be wonderful," Samuel Heckler said, and to Lindsay's amazement and mine, offered my sister his arm.
"What's that?"
asked Buckley, trailing behind and pointing to what he thought was a suitcase.
"An alto?" Samuel Heckler said.
"What?"
asked Buckley. Lindsay spoke then.
"Samuel plays the alto saxophone."
"Barely," Samuel said. My brother didn't ask what a saxophone was. He knew what Lindsay was being. She was being what I called snooty-wooty, as in, Buckley, don't worry. Lindsay's being snooty-wooty. Usually I'd tickle him as I said the word, sometimes burrowing into his stomach with my head, butting him and saying, snooty-wooty, over and over until his trills of laughter flowed down over me. Buckley followed the three of them into the kitchen and asked, as he had at least once a day, where's Susie? They were silent. Samuel looked at Lindsay. Buckley, my father called from the adjoining room, come play Monopoly with me. My brother had never been invited to play Monopoly. Everyone said he was too young, but this was the magic of Christmas. He rushed into the family room, and my father picked him up and sat him on his lap. See this shoe? My father said. Buckley nodded his head. I want you to listen to everything I say about it, okay? Susie? My brother asked, somehow connecting the two. Yes. I'm going to tell you where Susie is. I began to cry up in heaven. What else was there for me to do? This shoe was the piece Susie played Monopoly with, he said. I play with the car, or sometimes the wheelbarrow. Lindsay plays with the iron, and when your mother plays, she likes the cannon.
Is that a dog?
Yes, that's a Scotty.
Mine!
Okay, my father said. He was patient. He had found a way to explain it. He held his son in his lap, and as he spoke, he felt Buckley's small body on his knee. The very human, very warm, very alive weight of it. It comforted him. The Scotty will be your piece from now on. Which piece is Susie's again?
The shoe,
Buckley said. Right. And I'm the car, your sister's the iron, and your mother is the cannon. My brother concentrated very hard. Now, let's put all the pieces on the board, okay? You go ahead and do it for me. Buckley grabbed a fist of pieces and then another, until all the pieces lay between the chance and community chest cards. Let's say the other pieces are our friends.
Like Nate?
Right. We'll make your friend Nate the hat, and the board the world. Now, if I were to tell you that when I rolled the dice, one of the pieces would be taken away, what would that mean?
They can't play anymore?
Right.
Why?
Buckley asked. He looked up at my father. My father flinched.
Why?
My brother asked again. My father didn't want to say, because life is unfair, or because that's how it is. He wanted something neat, something that could explain death to a 4-year-old. He placed his hand on the small of Buckley's back. Susie is dead, he said now, unable to make it fit in the rules of any game. Do you know what that means? Buckley reached over with his hand and covered the shoe. He looked up to see if his answer was right. My father nodded. You won't see Susie anymore, honey. None of us will. My father cried. Buckley looked up into the eyes of our father and didn't fully understand. Buckley kept the shoe on his dresser until one day it wasn't there anymore, and no amount of looking for it could turn it up. In the kitchen, my mother finished her eggnog and excused herself. She went into the dining room and counted silverware, methodically laying out the 3 kinds of forks, the knives, and the spoons, making them climb the stairs, as she'd been taught when she worked in Wanamaker's bridal shop before I was born. She wanted a cigarette, and for her children who were living, to disappear for a while. Are you going to open your gift? Samuel Heckler asked my sister. They stood at the counter, leaning against the dishwasher and the drawers that held napkins and towels. In the room to their right sat my father and brother. On the other side of the kitchen, my mother was thinking Wedgwood Florentine, Cobalt Blue, Royal Worcester, Mountbatten, Lennox, Eternal. Lindsay smiled and pulled at the white ribbon on top of the box. My mom did the ribbon for me, Samuel Heckler said. She tore the blue paper away from the black velvet box. Carefully, she held it in her palm once the paper was off. In heaven, I was excited. When Lindsay and I played Barbies, Barbie and Ken got married at 16. To us, there was only one true love in everyone's life. We had no concept of compromise or retries. Open it, Samuel Heckler said. I'm scared. Don't be. He put his hand on her forearm and, wow, what I felt when he did that. Lindsay had a cute boy in the kitchen, vampire or no. This was news. This was a bulletin. I was suddenly privy to everything. She never would have told me any of this stuff. What the box held was typical, or disappointing, or miraculous, depending on the eye. It was typical because he was a 13-year-old boy, or it was disappointing because it wasn't a wedding ring, or it was miraculous. He'd given her a half a heart. It was gold, and from inside his huckapoo shirt, he pulled out the other side. It hung around his neck on a rawhide cord. Lindsay's face flushed. Mine flushed up in heaven. I forgot my father in the family room and my mother counting silver. I saw Lindsay move toward Samuel Heckler. She kissed him. It was glorious. I was almost alive again. Chapter 6. 2 weeks before my death, I left the house later than usual, and by the time I reached the school, the blacktop circle where the school buses usually hovered was empty. A hall monitor from the discipline office would write down your name if you tried to get in the front doors after the first bell rang, and I didn't want to be paged during class to come and sit on the hard bench outside Mr. Peterford's room, where, it was widely known, he would bend you over and paddle your behind with a board. He'd asked the shop teacher to drill holes in it for less wind resistance on the downstroke and more pain when it landed against your jeans. I had never been late enough or done anything bad enough to meet the board. But in my mind, as in every other kid's, I could visualize it so well my butt would sting. Clarissa had told me that the baby stoners, as they were called in junior high, used the back door to the stage, which was always left open by Cleo, the janitor, who had dropped out of high school as a full-blown stoner. So that day I crept into the backstage area, watching my step, careful not to trip over the various cords and wires. I paused near some scaffolding and put down my book bag to brush my hair. I'd taken to leaving the house in the Jingle Bell cap and then switching, as soon as I'd gained cover behind the O'Dwyer's house, to an old black watch cap of my father's. All this left my hair full of static electricity, and my first stop was usually the girls' room, where I would brush it flat. You are beautiful, Susie Salmon. I heard the voice, but couldn't place it immediately. I looked around me. Here, the voice said. I looked up and saw the head and torso of Ray Singh leaning out over the top of the scaffold above me. Hello, he said. I knew Ray Singh had a crush on me. He had moved from England the year before, but Clarissa said he was born in India. That someone could have the face of one country and the voice of another and then move to a third was too incredible for me to fathom. It made him immediately cool. plus, he seemed 800 times smarter than the rest of us, and he had a crush on me. What I finally realized were affectations, the smoking jacket that he sometimes wore to school and his foreign cigarettes, which were actually his mother's, I thought were evidence of his higher breeding. He knew and saw things that the rest of us didn't see. That morning when he spoke to me from above, my heart plunged to the floor. "Hasn't the first bell rung?" I asked. "I have Mr. Morton for homeroom," he said. This explained everything. Mr. Morton had a perpetual hangover, which was at its peak during homeroom. He never called roll. "What are you doing up there?" "Climb up and see," he said, removing his head and shoulders from my view. I hesitated. "Come on, Susie." It was my one day in life of being a bad kid, of at least feigning the moves. I placed my foot on the bottom rung of the scaffold and reached my arms up to the first crossbar. "Bring your stuff," Ray advised. I went back for my book bag and then climbed unsteadily up. "Let me help you," he said, and put his hands under my armpits, which even though covered by my winter parka, I was self-conscious about. I sat for a moment with my feet dangling over the side. "Tuck them in," he said. "That way no one will see us." I did what he told me, and then I stared at him for a moment. I felt suddenly stupid, unsure of why I was there. "Will you stay up here all day?" I asked. "Just until English class is over." "You're cutting English?" It was as if he'd said he'd robbed a bank. "I've seen every Shakespeare play put on by the Royal Shakespeare Company," Ray said. "That bitch has nothing to teach me." I felt sorry for Mrs. DeWitt then. If part of being bad was calling Mrs. DeWitt a bitch, I wasn't into it. "I like Othello," I ventured. "It's condescending twaddle the way she teaches it, a sort of black like me version of the Moor." Ray was smart. This combined with being an Indian from England had made him a Martian in Norristown. "That guy in the movie looked pretty stupid with black makeup on," I said.
"You mean Sir Laurence Olivier?"
Ray and I were quiet. Quiet enough to hear the bell for the end of homeroom ring, and then, 5 minutes later, the bell that meant we should be on the first floor in Mrs. DeWitt's class. As each second passed after that bell, I could feel my skin heat up and Ray's look lengthen out over my body, taking in my royal blue parka and my Kelly green miniskirt with my matching Danskin tights. My real shoes sat beside me inside my bag. On my feet, I had a pair of fake sheepskin boots with dirty synthetic shearing spilling out like animal innards around the tops and seams. If I had known this was to be the sex scene of my life, I might have prepared a bit, reapplied my strawberry banana kissing potion as I came in the door. I could feel Ray's body leaning toward me, the scaffolding underneath us squeaking from his movement. "He is from England," I was thinking. His lips moved closer. The scaffold listed. I was dizzy, about to go under the wave of my first kiss, when we both heard something. We froze. Ray and I lay down side by side and stared at the lights and wires overhead. A moment later, the stage door opened, and in walked Mr. Peterford and the art teacher, Miss Ryan, who were recognized by their voices. There was a third person with them.
"We aren't taking disciplinary action at this time, but we will if you persist," Mr. Peterford was saying. "Miss Ryan, did you bring the materials?"
"Yes."
Miss Ryan had come to Kennett from a Catholic school and taken over the art department from two ex-hippies who had been fired when the kiln exploded. Our art classes had gone from wild experiments with molten metals and throwing clay
to day after day of drawing profiles of wooden figures she placed in stiff positions at the beginning of each class.
I'm only doing the assignments.
It was Ruth Connors. I recognized the voice, and so did Ray. We all had Mrs. DeWitt's English class, first period.
This, Mr. Peterford said, wasn't the assignment.
Ray reached for my hand and squeezed. We knew what they were talking about. A Xerox copy of one of Ruth's drawings had been passed around in the library until it had reached a boy at the card catalog who was overtaken by the librarian.
If I'm not mistaken, said Miss Ryan, there are no breasts on our anatomy model.
The drawing had been of a woman reclining with her legs crossed. And it was no wooden figure with eye hooks connecting the limbs. It was a real woman. And the charcoal smudges of her eyes, whether by accident or intent, had given her a leering look that made every kid who saw it either highly uncomfortable or quite happy, thank you.
There isn't a nose or mouth on that wooden model either, Ruth said. But you encouraged us to draw in faces.
Again, Ray squeezed my hand.
That's enough, young lady, Mr. Peterford said. It is the attitude of repose in this particular drawing that clearly made it something the Nelson boy would Xerox.
Is that my fault?
Without the drawing, there would be no problem.
So it's my fault?
I invite you to realize the position this puts the school in and to assist us by drawing what Miss Ryan instructs the class to draw without making unnecessary additions.
Leonardo da Vinci drew cadavers, Ruth said softly.
Understood?
Yes, said Ruth.
The stage doors opened and shut, and a moment later Ray and I could hear Ruth Connors crying. Ray mouthed the word go, and I moved to the end of the scaffold, dangling my foot over the side to find a hold. That week, Ray would kiss me by my locker. It didn't happen up on the scaffold when he'd wanted it to. Our only kiss was like an accident, a beautiful gasoline rainbow. I climbed down off the scaffold with my back to her. She didn't move or hide, just looked at me when I turned around. She was sitting on a wooden crate near the back of the stage. A pair of old curtains hung to her left. She watched me walk toward her, but didn't wipe her eyes.
Susie Salmon, she said, just to confirm it.
The possibility of my cutting first period and hiding backstage in the auditorium was, until that day, as remote as the smartest girl in our class being bawled out by the discipline officer. I stood in front of her, hat in hand.
That's a stupid hat, she said.
I lifted the jingle bell cap and looked at it.
I know. My mom made it.
So you heard?
Can I see?
Ruth unfolded the much-handled Xerox, and I stared. Using a blue ballpoint pen, Brian Nelson had made an obscene hole where her legs were crossed. I recoiled, and she watched me. I could see something flicker in her eyes, a private wondering, and then she leaned over and brought out a black leather sketchbook from her knapsack. Inside, it was beautiful. Drawings of women mostly, but of animals and men too. I'd never seen anything like it before. Each page was covered in her drawings. I realized how subversive Ruth was then, not because she drew pictures of nude women that got misused by her peers, but because she was more talented than her teachers. She was the quietest kind of rebel. Helpless, really.
You're really good, Ruth, I said.
Thank you, she said,
and I kept looking through the pages of her book and drinking it in. I was both frightened and excited by what existed underneath the black line of the navel in those drawings, what my mother called the baby-making machinery. I told Lindsay I'd never have one, and when I was 10, I'd spent the better part of 6 months telling any adult who would listen that I intended on getting my tubes tied. I didn't know what this meant exactly, but I knew it was drastic, required surgery, and it made my father laugh out loud. Ruth went from weird to special for me then. The drawings were so good that in that moment I forgot the rules of school. All the bells and whistles, which as kids we were supposed to respond to. After the cornfield was roped off, searched, then abandoned, Ruth went walking there. She would wrap a large wool shawl of her grandmother's around her under the ratty old pea coat of her father's. Soon she noted that teachers in subjects besides gym didn't report her if she cut. They were happy not to have her there. Her intelligence made her a problem. It demanded attention and rushed their lesson plans forward. And she began to take rides from her father in the mornings to avoid the bus. He left very early and brought his red metal sloped-top lunchbox, which he had allowed her to pretend was a barn for her Barbies when she was little, and in which he now tucked bourbon. Before he let her out in the empty parking lot, he would stop his truck but keep the heater running.
"Going to be okay today?"
he always asked. Ruth nodded.
"One for the road?"
And without nodding this time, she handed him the lunchbox. He opened it, unscrewed the bourbon, took a deep swallow, and then passed it to her. She threw her head back dramatically and either placed her tongue against the glass so very little would make it to her mouth, or took a small, wincing gulp if he was watching her. She slid out of the high cab. It was cold, bitterly cold, before the sun rose. Then she remembered a fact from one of our classes. People moving are warmer than people at rest. So she began to walk directly to the cornfield, keeping a good pace. She talked to herself, and sometimes she thought about me. Often she would rest a moment against the chain-link fence that separated the soccer field from the track, while she watched the world come alive around her. So we met each morning in those first few months. The sun would come up over the cornfield, and Holiday, let loose by my father, would come to chase rabbits in and out of the tall, dry stalks of dead corn. The rabbits loved the trimmed lawns of the athletic fields, and as Ruth approached, she'd see their dark forms line up along the white chalk of the farthest boundaries like some sort of tiny sports team. She liked the idea of this, and I did too. She believed stuffed animals moved at night when humans went to sleep. She still thought in her father's lunchbox there might be minute cows and sheep that found time to graze on the bourbon and bologna. When Lindsay left the gloves from Christmas for me, in between the farthest boundary of the soccer field and the cornfield, I looked down one morning to see the rabbits investigate, sniff at the corners of the gloves lined with their own kin. Then I saw Ruth pick them up before Holiday grabbed them. She turned the bottom of one glove so the fur faced out and held it up to her cheek. She looked up to the sky and said, "Thank you." I like to think she was talking to me. I grew to love Ruth on those mornings, feeling that in some way we could never explain on our opposite sides of the in-between. We were born to keep each other company. Odd girls who had found each other in the strangest way. In the shiver she had felt when I passed. Ray was a walker. Like me, living at the far end of our development, which surrounded the school. He had seen Ruth Connors walking alone out on the soccer fields. Since Christmas, he had come and gone to my school as quickly as he could, never lingering. He wanted my killer to be caught almost as much as my parents did. Until he was, Ray couldn't wipe the traces of suspicion off himself, despite his alibi. He chose a morning when his father wasn't going to work at the university and filled his father's thermos with his mother's sweet tea. He left early to wait for Ruth and made a little camp of the cement shot put circle, sitting on the metal curve against which the shot putters braced their feet. When he saw her walking on the other side of the chain link fence that separated the school from the soccer field and inside, which was the most revered of the sports fields, the football one, he rubbed his hands together and prepared what he wanted to say. His bravery this time came not from having kissed me, a goal he'd set himself a full year before its completion, but from being, at 14, intensely lonely. I watched Ruth approach the soccer field, thinking she was alone. In an old home her father had gone to scavenge, he had found her a treat to go along with her new hobby, an anthology of poems. She held them close. She saw Ray stand up when she was still some distance away. "Hello, Ruth Connors," he called and waved his arms. Ruth looked over, and his name came into her head, Ray Singh. But she didn't know much more than that. She had heard the rumors about the police being over at his house, but she believed what her father had said. No kid did that. And so she walked over to him. "I prepared tea and have it in my thermos here," Ray said. I blushed for him up in heaven. He was smart when it came to Othello, but now he was acting like a geek. "No, thank you," Ruth said. She stood near him, but with a definite few feet more than usual still in between. Her fingernails were pressed into the worn cover of the poetry anthology. "I was there that day when you and Susie talked backstage," Ray said. He held the thermos out to her. She made no move closer and didn't respond. "Susie Salmon," he clarified. "I know who you mean," she said. "Are you going to the memorial service?" "I didn't know there was one," she said. "I don't think I'm going." I was staring hard at his lips. They were redder than usual from the cold. Ruth took a step forward. "Do you want some lip balm?" Ruth asked. Ray lifted his wool gloves up to his lips, where they snagged briefly on the chapped surface that I had kissed. Ruth dug her hands in the peacoat pocket and pulled out her chapstick. "Here," she said. "I have tons of them. You can keep it." "That's so nice," he said. "Will you at least sit with me until the buses come?" They sat together on the shot putter's cement platform. Again, I was seeing something I never would have seen. The two of them together. It made Ray more attractive to me than he had ever been. His eyes were the darkest gray. When I watched him from heaven, I didn't hesitate to fall inside of them. It became a ritual for the two of them. On the days that his father taught, Ruth brought him a little bourbon in her father's flask. Otherwise, they had sweet tea. They were cold as hell, but that didn't seem to matter to them. They talked about what it was like to be a foreigner in Norristown. They read poems aloud from Ruth's anthology. They talked about how to become what they wanted to be. A doctor for Ray, a painter-poet for Ruth. They made a secret club of the other oddballs they could point out in our class. There were the obvious ones like Mike Bales, who had taken so much acid, no one understood how he was still in school. Or Jeremiah, who was from Louisiana, and so just as much a foreigner as Ray. Then there were the quiet ones. Artie, who talked excitedly to anyone about the effects of formaldehyde. Harry Orland, who was so painfully shy he wore his gym shorts over his jeans. And Vicky Kurtz, who everyone thought was okay after the death of her mother,
but whom Ruth had seen sleeping in a bed of pine needles behind the junior high's regulating plant. And sometimes they would talk about me.
It's so strange, Ruth said. I mean, it's like we were in the same class since kindergarten, but that day backstage in the auditorium was the first time we ever looked at each other.
She was great, Ray said. He thought of our lips brushing past one another as we stood alone in a column of lockers. How I had smiled with my eyes closed and then almost run away.
Do you think they'll find him?
I guess so. You know, we're only like 100 yards away from where it happened.
I know, he said.
They both sat on the thin metal rim of the shot putter's brace, holding tea in their gloved hands. The cornfield had become a place no one went. When a ball strayed from the soccer field, a boy took a dare to go in and get it. That morning the sun was slicing right through the dead stalks as it rose, but there was no heat from it.
I found these here, she said, indicating the leather gloves.
Do you ever think about her? He asked. They were quiet again.
All the time, Ruth said. A chill ran down my spine. Sometimes I think she's lucky, you know. I hate this place.
Me too, Ray said. But I've lived other places. This is just a temporary hell, not a permanent one.
You're not implying
she's in heaven, if you believe in that stuff.
You don't?
I don't think so, no.
I do, Ruth said. I don't mean la-la angel wing crap, but I do think there's a heaven.
Is she happy?
It is heaven, right?
But what does that mean?
The tea was stone cold, and the first bell had already rung. Ruth smiled into her cup.
Well, as my dad would say, it means she's out of this shithole.
When my father knocked on the door of Ray Singh's house, he was struck dumb by Ray's mother, Ruwana. It wasn't that she was immediately welcoming, and she was far from sunny, but something about her dark hair and her gray eyes, and even the strange way she seemed to step back from the door once she opened it, all of these things overwhelmed him. He had heard the offhand comments the police made about her. To their mind, she was cold and snobbish, condescending, odd. And so that was what he imagined he would find.
Come in and sit, she'd said to him when he pronounced his name.
Her eyes, on the word salmon, had gone from closed to open doorways, dark rooms where he wanted to travel firsthand. He almost lost his balance as she led him into the small, cramped front room of their house. There were books on the floor with their spines facing up. They came out three rows deep from the wall. She was wearing a yellow sari and what looked like gold lamé capri pants underneath. Her feet were bare. She padded across the wall to wall and stopped at the couch.
Something to drink? She asked,
and he nodded his head.
Hot or cold?
Hot. As she turned the corner into a room he couldn't see, he sat down on the brown plaid couch. The windows across from him, under which the books were lined, were draped with long muslin curtains, which the harsh daylight outside had to fight to filter through. He felt suddenly very warm, almost close to forgetting why that morning he had double-checked the Singh's address. A little while later, as my father was thinking of how tired he was and how he had promised my mother to pick up some long-held dry cleaning, Mrs. Singh returned with tea on a tray and put it down on the carpet in front of him.
We don't have much furniture, I'm afraid. Dr. Singh is still looking for tenure. She went into an adjoining room and brought back a purple floor pillow for herself, which she placed on the floor to face him.
Dr. Singh is a professor? My father asked, though he knew this already, knew more than he was comfortable with about this beautiful woman and her sparsely furnished home.
Yes, she said, and poured the tea.
It was quiet. She held out a cup to him, and as he took it, she said,
Ray was with him the day your daughter was killed.
He wanted to fall over into her.
That must be why you've come, she continued.
Yes, he said.
I want to talk to him.
He's at school right now, she said.
You know that.
Her legs in the gold pants were tucked to her side. The nails on her toes were long and unpolished, their surface gnarled from years of dancing.
I wanted to come by and assure you I mean him no harm, my father said.
I watched him. I had never seen him like this before. The words fell out of him like burdens he was delivering, backlogged verbs and nouns. But he was watching her feet curl against the dun-colored rug and the way the small pool of numbed light from the curtains touched her right cheek.
He did nothing wrong and loved your little girl. A schoolboy crush, but still.
Schoolboy crushes happened all the time to Ray's mother. The teenager who delivered the paper would pause on his bike, hoping that she would be near the door when she heard the thump of the Philadelphia Inquirer hit the porch, that she would come out, and if she did, that she would wave. She didn't even have to smile, and she rarely did outside her house. It was the eyes, her dancer's carriage, the way she seemed to deliberate over the smallest movement of her body. When the police had come, they had stumbled into the dark front hall in search of a killer. But before Ray even reached the top of the stairs, Ruwana had so confused them that they were agreeing to tea and sitting on silk pillows. They had expected her to fall into the grooves of the patter they relied on with all attractive women. But she only grew more erect in posture as they tried harder and harder to ingratiate themselves, and she stood upright by the windows while they questioned her son.
I'm glad Susie had a nice boy like her, my father said. I'll thank your son for that.
She smiled, not showing teeth.
He wrote her a love note, he said.
Yes.
I wish I had known enough to do the same, he said. Tell her I loved her on that last day.
Yes.
But your son did.
Yes.
They stared at each other for a moment. You must have driven the policeman nuts, he said, and smiled more to himself than to her.
They came to accuse Ray, she said. I wasn't concerned with how they felt about me.
I imagine it's been hard for him, my father said.
No, I won't allow that, she said sternly, and placed her cup back on the tray. You cannot have sympathy for Ray or for us.
My father tried to stutter out a protest. She placed her hand in the air.
You have lost a daughter and come here for some purpose. I will allow you that and that only. But trying to understand our lives, no.
I didn't mean to offend, he said. I only...
Again, the hand up. Ray will be home in 20 minutes. I will talk to him first and prepare him. Then you may talk to my son about your daughter.
What did I say?
I like that we don't have much furniture. It allows me to think that someday we might pack up and leave.
I hope you'll stay, my father said.
He said it because he had been trained to be polite from an early age, a training he passed on to me. But he also said it because part of him wanted more of her.
This cold woman who wasn't exactly cold. This rock who wasn't stone.
With all gentleness, she said, you don't even know me. We'll wait together for Ray.
My father had left our house in the midst of a fight between Lindsay and my mother. My mother was trying to get Lindsay to go with her to the Y to swim. Without thinking, Lindsay had blared, I'd rather die, at the top of her lungs. My father watched as my mother froze, then burst, fleeing to their bedroom to wail behind the door. He quietly tucked his notebook in his jacket pocket, took the car keys off the hook by the back door, and snuck out. In those first 2 months, my mother and father moved in opposite directions from each other. One stayed in, the other went out. My father fell asleep in his den in the green chair, and when he woke, he crept carefully into the bedroom and slid into bed. If my mother had most of the sheets, he would lie without them, his body curled up tight, ready to spring at a moment's notice, ready for anything. I know who killed her, he heard himself say to Ruwana Singh.
Have you told the police?
Yes.
What do they say?
They say that for now there is nothing but my suspicion to link him to the crime.
A father's suspicion, she began,
is as powerful as a mother's intuition. This time there were teeth in her smile.
He lives in the neighborhood. What are you doing?
I'm investigating all leads, my father said, knowing how it sounded as he said it.
And my son
is a lead.
Perhaps the other man frightens you too much.
But I have to do something, he protested.
Here we are again, Mr. Salmon, she said. You misinterpret me. I am not saying you are doing the wrong thing by coming here. It is the right thing in its way. You want to find something soft, something warm in all this. Your searching led you here. That's a good thing. I am only concerned that it be good, too, for my son.
I mean no harm.
What is the man's name?
George Harvey. It was the first time he'd said it aloud to anyone but Len Fennerman. She paused and stood. Turning her back to him, she walked over to first one window and then the other, and drew the curtains back. It was the after-school light that she loved. She watched for Ray as he walked up the road.
Ray will come now. I will go to meet him. If you'll excuse me, I need to put on my coat and boots.
She paused.
Mr. Salmon, she said, I would do exactly what you are doing. I would talk to everyone I needed to. I wouldn't tell too many people his name. When I was sure, she said, I would find a quiet way, and I would kill him.
He could hear her in the hallway, the metal clank of hangers as she got her coat. A few minutes later, the door was opened and closed. A cold breeze came in from the outside, and then out on the road he could see a mother greet her son. Neither of them smiled, their heads bent low, their mouths moved. Ray took in the fact that my father was waiting for him inside his home. At first, my mother and I thought it was just the obvious that marked Len Fennerman as different from the rest of the force. He was smaller than the hulking uniforms who frequently accompanied him. Then there were the less obvious traits, too, the way he often seemed to be thinking to himself, how he wasn't much for joking or trying to be anything but serious when he talked about me and the circumstances of the case. But talking with my mother, Len Fennerman had shown himself for what he was, an optimist. He believed my killer would be caught.
Maybe not today or tomorrow, he said to my mother, but someday he'll do something uncontrollable.
They are too uncontrolled in their habits not to. My mother was left to entertain Len Fennerman until my father arrived home from the Sings. On the table in the family room, Buckley's crayons were scattered across the butcher paper my mother had laid down. Buckley and Nate had drawn until their heads began to nod like heavy flowers, and my mother had plucked them up in her arms, first one and then the other, and brought them over to the couch. They slept there, end to end, with their feet almost touching in the center. Len Fennerman knew enough to talk in hushed whispers. But he wasn't, my mother noted, a worshipper of children. He watched her carry the two boys, but didn't stand to help or comment on them the way the other policemen always did, defining her by her children, both living and dead. "Jack wants to talk to you," my mother said, "but I'm sure you're too busy to wait." "Not too busy." I saw a black strand of her hair fall from where she had tucked it behind her ear. It softened her face. I saw Len see it too. "He went over to that poor Ray Sings house," she said, and tucked the fallen hair back in its proper place. "I'm sorry we had to question him," Len said. "Yes," she said. "No young boy is capable of..." She couldn't say it, and he didn't make her. His alibi was airtight. My mother took up a crayon from the butcher paper. Len Fennerman watched my mother draw stick figures and stick dogs. Buckley and Nate made quiet sounds of sleep on the couch. My brother curled up into a fetal position, and a moment later placed his thumb in his mouth to suck. It was a habit my mother had told us all we must help him break. Now she envied such easy peace. "You remind me of my wife," Len said after a long silence, during which my mother had drawn an orange poodle and what looked like a blue horse undergoing electric shock treatment. "She can't draw either?" "She wasn't much of a talker when there was nothing to say." A few more minutes passed, a yellow ball of sun, a brown house with flowers outside the door, pink, blue, purple. "You used the past tense." They both heard the garage door. "She died soon after we were married," he said.
"Daddy!"
Buckley yelled and leapt up, forgetting Nate and everyone else. "I'm sorry," she said to Len. "I am too," he said. "About Susie. Really." In the back hall, my father greeted Buckley and Nate with high cheers and calls for oxygen, as he always did when we besieged him after a long day. Even if it felt false, elevating his mood for my brother was often the favorite part of his day. My mother stared at Len Fennerman while my father walked toward the family room from the back. "Rush to the sink," I felt like saying to her. "Stare down the hole and look into the earth. I'm down there waiting. I'm up here watching." Len Fennerman had been the one that first asked my mother for my school picture when the police thought I might be found alive. In his wallet, my photo sat in a stack. Among these dead children and strangers was a picture of his wife. If a case had been solved, he had written the date of its resolution on the back of the photo. If the case was still open, in his mind, if not in the official files of the police, it was blank. There was nothing on the back of mine. There was nothing on his wife's. "Len, how are you?" my father asked. Holiday, up and wiggling back and forth for my father to pet him. "I hear you went to see Ray Sings," Len said.
"Boys, why don't you go play up in Buckley's room?" my mother suggested. "Detective Fennerman and Daddy need to talk."
Chapter 7.
Do you see her?
Buckley asked Nate as they climbed the stairs, Holiday in tow.
That's my sister.
No,
Nate said.
She was gone for a while, but now she's back. Race!
And the three of them, two boys and a dog, raced the rest of the way up the long curve of the staircase. I had never even let myself yearn for Buckley, afraid he might see my image in a mirror or a bottle cap. Like everyone else, I was trying to protect him.
Too young, I said to Franny.
Where do you think imaginary friends come from? She said.
For a few minutes, the two boys sat under the framed grave rubbing outside my parents' room. It was from a tomb in a London graveyard. My mother had told Lindsay and me the story of how my father and she had wanted things to hang on their walls, and an old woman they met on their honeymoon had taught them how to do grave rubbings. By the time I was in double digits, most of the grave rubbings had been put down in the basement for storage. The spots on our suburban walls replaced with bright graphic prints meant to stimulate children. But Lindsay and I loved the grave rubbings, particularly the one under which Nate and Buckley sat that afternoon. Lindsay and I would lie down on the floor underneath it. I would pretend to be the knight that was pictured, and Holiday was the faithful dog curled up at his feet. Lindsay would be the wife he'd left behind. It always dissolved into giggles, no matter how solemn the start. Lindsay would tell the dead knight that a wife had to move on, that she couldn't be trapped for the rest of her life by a man who was frozen in time. I would act stormy and mad, but it never lasted. Eventually, she would describe her new lover, the fat butcher who gave her prime cuts of meat, the agile blacksmith who made her hooks.
You are dead, knight, she would say. Time to move on.
Last night she came in and kissed me on the cheek, Buckley said.
Did not.
Did too.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you told your mom?
It's a secret, Buckley said. Susie told me she isn't ready to talk to them yet. Do you want to see something else?
Sure, said Nate.
The two of them stood up to go to the children's side of the house, leaving Holiday asleep under the grave rubbing.
Come look, Buckley said.
They were in my room. The picture of my mother had been taken by Lindsay. After reconsideration, she had come back for the hippy-dippy says love button, too.
Susie's room, Nate said.
Buckley put his fingers to his lips. He'd seen my mother do this when she wanted us to be quiet, and now he wanted that from Nate. He got down on his belly and gestured for Nate to follow, and they wriggled like Holiday as they made their way beneath the dust ruffle of my bed into my secret storage space. In the material that was stretched on the underside of the box spring, there was a hole, and stuffed up inside were things I didn't want anyone else to see. I had to guard it from Holiday, or he would scratch at it to try and pry the objects loose. This had been exactly what happened 24 hours after I went missing. My parents had searched my room hoping to find a note of explanation, and then left the door open. Holiday had carried off the licorice I kept there. Strewn beneath my bed were the objects I'd kept hidden, and one of them only Buckley and Nate would recognize. Buckley unwrapped an old handkerchief of my father's, and there it was, the stained and bloody twig. The year before, a 3-year-old Buckley had swallowed it. Nate and he had been shoving rocks up their noses in our backyard, and Buckley had found a small twig under the oak tree where my mother strung one end of the clothesline. He put the stick in his mouth like a cigarette. I watched him from the roof outside my bedroom window, where I was sitting painting my toenails with Clarissa's magenta glitter and reading 17. I was perpetually assigned the job of watching out for little brother. Lindsay wasn't thought to be old enough. Besides, she was a burgeoning brain which meant she got to be free to do things like spend that summer afternoon drawing detailed pictures of a fly's eye on graph paper with her 130 pack of Prisma colors. It wasn't too hot out, and it was summer, and I was going to spend my internment at home beautifying. I had begun the morning by showering, shampooing, and steaming myself. On the roof, I air-dried and applied lacquer. I had on two coats of magenta glitter when a fly landed on the bottle's applicator. I heard Nate making dare and threat sounds, and I squinted at the fly to try to make out all the quadrants of his eyes that Lindsay was coloring inside the house. A breeze came up, blowing the fringe on my cutoffs against my thighs.
"Susie! Susie!"
Nate was yelling. I looked down to see Buckley on the ground. It was this day that I always told Holly about when we talked about rescue. I believed it was possible. She didn't. I swung my legs around and scrambled through my open window, one foot landing on the sewing stool and the other immediately in front of that one and on the braided rug, and then down on my knees and out of the blocks like an athlete. I ran down the hall and slid down the banister as we'd been forbidden to do. I called Lindsay's name and then forgot her, ran out to the backyard through the screened-in porch, and jumped over the dog fence to the oak tree. Buckley was choking, his body bucking, and I carried him with Nate trailing into the garage, where my father's precious Mustang sat. I had watched my parents drive, and my mother had shown me how a car went from park to reverse. I put Buckley in the back and grabbed the keys from the unused terracotta pots where my father hid them. I sped all the way to the hospital. I burned out the emergency brake, but no one seemed to care.
"If she hadn't been there," the doctor later told my mother, "you would have lost your little boy."
Grandma Lynn predicted I'd have a long life because I had saved my brothers. As usual, Grandma Lynn was wrong.
"Wow,"
Nate said, holding the twig and marveling at how, over time, red blood turned black.
"Yeah,"
said Buckley. His stomach felt queasy with the memory of it. How much pain he had been in, how the faces of the adults changed as they surrounded him in the huge hospital bed. He had seen them that serious only one other time. But whereas in the hospital their eyes had been worried and then later not, shot through with so much light and relief that they'd enveloped him, now our parents' eyes had gone flat and not returned. I felt faint in heaven that day. I reeled back in the gazebo and my eyes snapped open. It was dark, and across from me stood a large building that I had never been in. I had read James and the Giant Peach when I was little. The building looked like the house of his aunts, huge and dark and Victorian. It had a widow's walk. For a moment, as I readjusted to the darkness, I thought I saw a long row of women standing on the widow's walk and pointing my way. But a moment later, I saw differently. Crows were lined up, their beaks holding crooked twigs. As I stood to go back to the duplex, they took wing and followed me. Had my brother really seen me somehow? Or was he merely a little boy telling beautiful lies? Chapter 8. For 3 months, Mr. Harvey dreamed of buildings. He saw a slice of Yugoslavia where thatched roof dwellings on stilts gave way to rushing torrents of water from below. There were blue skies overhead. Along the fjords and in the hidden valley of Norway, he saw wooden stave churches, the timbers of which had been carved by Viking boat builders. Dragons and local heroes made from wood. But there was one building, from the Vologda, that he dreamed about most. The Church of the Transfiguration. And it was this dream, his favorite, that he had on the night of my murder, and on the nights following until the others came back.
The not still dreams. The ones of women and children.
I could see all the way back to Mr. Harvey in his mother's arms, staring out over a table covered with pieces of colored glass. His father sorted them into piles by shape and size, depth and weight. His father's jeweler's eyes looked deeply into each specimen for cracks and flaws, and George Harvey would turn his attention to the single jewel that hung from his mother's neck, a large oval-shaped piece of amber framed by silver, inside of which sat a whole and perfect fly. A builder was all Mr. Harvey said when he was young. Then he stopped answering the question of what his father did. How could he say he worked in the desert and that he built shacks of broken glass and old wood? He lectured George Harvey on what made a good building, on how to make sure you were constructing things to last. So it was his father's old sketchbooks that Mr. Harvey looked at when the not-still dreams came back. He would steep himself in the images of other places and other worlds, trying to love what he didn't. And then he would begin to dream dreams of his mother, the last time he had seen her, running through a field on the side of the road. She had been dressed in white. White capri pants and a tight white boat-neck shirt. And his father had said she had fought for the last time in the hot car outside of Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. He had forced her out of the car. George Harvey sat still as a stone in the back seat, eyes wide, no more afraid than a stone, watching it all as he did everything by then, in slow-mo. She had run without stopping, her white body thin and fragile and disappearing, while her son clung on to the amber necklace she had torn from her neck to hand him. His father had watched the road.
"She's gone now, son," he said. "She won't be coming back."
This ends Disc 3.